surface. They're stuck onto these wax crystals, and the crystals are not very tightly attached to the plant, so it's sort of like trying to walk up a sand dune. So there's lots of slipping going on. We have very nice studies, which I'm not going to go into now, showing that they can't hang onto the plant. Their ability to adhere is very low. However, on the reduced wax plant, which is caused by a single mutation called WEL, you have an 80% reduction in the amount of wax. You also have a big a change in the morphology of the wax, so that it's not a crystalline structure, and a change in the chemical composition of the wax. And these plants are much easier to hold on to. And this is apparent, this manifests in a real change in the foraging ability of the ladybugs on the plants. And this is a functional response of Hippodamia convergens larvae eating pea aphids on waxy, at the normal wax plants, the crystalline plants, and the reduced wax plants are the dark green because they look darker. So throughout the talk, dark green is going to be the reduced wax plants and the bright green is going to be the normal wax plants. And as you can see, there's a pretty large difference in the amount of prey that they're able to eat. And that persists up until you have up there at 128 aphids. When there's so many aphids on the plant, you don't have to move very far to eat all the aphids you can eat. And then the effect becomes less important. This also translates into field level differences in P. aphid populations on the two cultivars on the reduced wax plants. And this is a graph of field data from Idaho over the course of the summer and weeks 1 through 7 on the X and the number of aphids per plant. And you can see that on the reduced wax plants, there's many fewer aphids than on the normal wax plants. And experiments with that I won't go into here with field cages show that this is indeed an effect of the predators and the difference in the predator foraging ability on the plants. So this effect also, the wax on the plant also impacts how predators foraging on the plant interact with each other and their ability to forage when there's other predators there. And this is an experiment that was done by White and Eichenbrode in 2000, and they examined how effective the predators were when there was one predator and when there was two predator. And on this side here on the reduced wax bloom, on the top line is the population of aphids over 3 days, 24, 48, and 72 hours. And the aphid population stayed fairly steady over that time. When you had one predator, the aphid population was reduced. When you added two predators, the aphid population was reduced even more. As you would expect, there was additive predation. You add more predators, you add more predation. However, on the normal wax plants, they did not see that effect. Over time, if you added more predators, you did not add more predation. So you have one predator, you get some predation, you add two predators, in this you don't get any more predation. So something about this wax, the normal wax, somehow the normal wax is impacting the ability of the predators to is mediating the interference between these two predators. It's causing non-additive predation. Okay, so we were trying to think about what were the mechanisms of this type of interference. How are they actually interfering? And we came up with a number of different mechanisms, and I'm going to just go through them, and I'll show you how we experimentally tried to get at what this mechanism was. We looked at behavioral interactions to see whether or not they were actually physically affecting each other on the plant. Another idea was that there's refugia on the plant. The plant is very slippery. They can't access the leaf blade. So in effect, for the predators foraging on the normal wax plants, there are less aphids available in the first place. So even if there's 64 aphids there, there's only 30 of them that are available, you add another predator, they're not going to eat anymore because they're just not available to them because they're in these refugia. And then finally, the chemistry. We might have, we know that the different, that there's a difference in the plant wax chemistry. Oh, you're kidding me. 4 minutes? Oh, my God. Okay. So we thought maybe that would be, that might affect their pheromones that they use. Okay, so I'm going to go through this very, very quickly. So differences in foraging behavior, we thought perhaps because they can only occupy certain parts of the plant that they would encounter each other more often and that they would cause disruption to each other more often on the normal wax plants than on the reduced wax plants. And to look at that, we filmed them and scored their encounters, aggression, and behavior. We didn't see what we expected to see. They did not encounter each other more often on the reduced on the normal wax plants. They encountered each other more often actually on the reduced wax plants. And when they encountered each other, that encounters, the nature of the encounter was not changed by the wax type. And nor was there sort of a overall effect of having two predators on the plant on the amount of time they spent on the plant or the number of times they fell off the plant. So with the behavior, there didn't seem to be, the observations, there didn't seem to be any basis for a direct sort of combative interguild predation type of interference going on. Then we did this experiment to look at the potential for refugia, and what we did is we had larvae on the plant for either two larvae on the plant at the same time, or one larva on the plant one day, and the next larva on the plant the next day. So these, in both of these treatments, there's two larval days worth of predation, but this one it was simultaneous, and that one they were there together, and this one they weren't. And if there was still interference occurring when the two larvae were on the plant sequentially, then it couldn't have been that they were actually physically fighting each other or some other type of encounter like that. And we thought maybe this is refugia. The aphid on the larva on the first day would be eating up all the available aphids, and the larva on the second day had slim pickings. And I'm not going to go into that. So when we looked at it, we did indeed see that there was interference again, and that interference occurred on the normal wax plants, whether they were on the plant at the same time or if they were in the plant one day and one the next day. It didn't matter. So the interference was not dependent on them being on the same plant at the same time. And when we looked at the proportion of aphids that were eaten each day on the normal wax plants, where there's the interference, they ate a fairly high proportion of aphids the first day, and the second day they just didn't eat very much at all. So that is consistent with the idea that there might be some refugia. Mm-hmm. However, when we looked at where they were on the plant, there wasn't a big change in the places that the aphids were on the plant from day to day, and we would have expected there to be a change, that there would be much more aphids on the leaves on the normal wax plants than on the stems as the days went by, and there just wasn't that shift. So that didn't seem to be the case. So then we looked at the potential of larval trails and the interaction with the wax type. And as we heard earlier in some talks, that coccinellids leave trails, the larvae leave trails, and they're avoided by other predators, or by parasitoids. Bill talked about that. And they're avoided by adults. Adults don't tend to oviposit next to larval trails because they don't want their eggs to be eaten by rampaging larvae. And there's been suggestions that individual larvae might use them to avoid revisiting the same areas of the plant. And larvae might use them to avoid each other as well. And so we thought maybe that because the plant composition was different, it would carry those trails differently, and we might see a different impact on the two plant types. So basically we did an experiment where we let larvae walk on a leaf, and then they gave a choice to a larva the next day whether it wanted to be on a plant. The pinky plant is one that's been trailed. The other one is a control leaflet for normal and reduced wax. And we found that the larvae avoid a leaflet that's been walked on by a conspecific larvae on the normal wax plants, but on the reduced wax plants, we don't see that effect. So in effect, when they're on the normal wax plant, that second day when they're walking on the plant, it's covered with trails saying there's been another larvae here. Maybe the area is foraged out, maybe there's danger of inter-guild predation, but avoid those areas so that the plant is very much restricted. The amount of plants that they can forage on is really restricted, whereas on the reduced whack plants, they don't have any hint of that. The end. Okay. Thanks for your patience.
Yeah, I think the most important thing I've learned so far today is how to put a harness on a cockroach. That intrigued me. I had to work on that. How many in here are presently involved in some capacity in working with a secondary science teacher preparation? At least half of you have some involvement in that program at the present time. I'm going to suggest that this is a crucial audience for a variety of reasons, but let's just play with the concept and come up with some rationale why we've got to form some relationships. And in a Research One institution, that doesn't happen. I almost wish I were in a smaller institution where, you know, you could get everybody that's involved in science in one room and you talk about what the needs are and you work out a plan of action. In a Research One institution, I'm on one side of the street and then the rest of the world is on the other side of the street. And it doesn't work real well. We have something called NCATE in the United States, the National Council for Accreditation and Teacher Education. And we also have TEAC for smaller institutions. Those two agencies actually sort of dictate what standards a teacher in science should have in their possession to be certified. The NCATE turns that responsibility over then to NSTA, the National Science Teachers Association, to be the monitoring agency. But ultimately, there are 10 different areas that a teacher has to show competency. And if you look at these areas, I'm going to suggest that out of these, there's a heavy, heavy burden on the science faculty in preparation for these components. In other words, a methods class in student teaching isn't going to take care of this. Obviously, the content is crucial to be handled, but right here, those three in particular, are just things that we've got to deal with, and basically they don't occur in a normal stereotypic lecture format content course. Now we're going to take a look at the same list for a moment, and I'm going to suggest that a research experience can impact this list. Basically everything except general teaching skills, curriculum, and assessment we really can deal with effectively in a research experience to enhance at least all of these areas. I'm going to suggest that our teachers that are coming out right now really do not, they actually do have a pretty good content background, by the way. But that's not been a problem in my experience. I would say, though, that we have teachers that could not define the nature of science. And that scares me. They don't really understand inquiry, and these are national standards now that not only have to be present for teacher preparation, but the inquiry has to be present in their teaching. They're supposed to be teaching with inquiry. Issues. Do they really understand how to deal with an issue related to science? Science, technology, and societal issues. Can they deal with an issue in a class setting and deal with that logically and with a lack of bias? Can they really bring science into the community and safety? It's a huge gap right now in teacher preparation. I would say the number one area where the certification process, they get dinged and actually fail their certification, is right there. Because they're really not taught in a lot of the science classes appropriate safety concerns. Because they're not really involved in the science of it. So all of those are really major concerns that we just really need to have your help, is what it amounts to. We've got to have a cooperation between the two groups on both sides of the road. If we look at the evolution of science experiences, a young man in my class last week, he's been with me now 12 months, two semesters. Over the summer, I didn't work with him that much. Starts student teaching January 14th. So we summarized the other day, how are you feeling in terms of preparation? You ready? Where are the holes? Tell me what your gut tells you. And with tears in his eyes, this undergrad said, I came in here into this room a year ago knowing what teaching looked like. And now I don't have a clue. Because everything that I thought I knew, you've taken away from me. Of course, I was proud. But let's take a look at what the problem was. He really, out of the University of Iowa, there too. He, out of the University of Nebraska, had lecture. Our morning person, actually, Martha and I had the same advisor and graduated out of the University of Iowa, so that was an interesting connection. I didn't expect to run into a science education grad at entomology. We at least get some people recognizing maybe they ought to do demos. And this is an evolution. This is a major push. I actually surveyed, in light of coming here, I went to a private high school in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I asked several of my student teachers who were there, I said, do me a favor, in your 10th grade and your 12th grade, well, actually we did 10, 11, and 12, we did chemistry, physics, and biology. They were to survey their classes and ask, on average, how many labs they thought they had a year in their science classes, and to name some of those lab experiences that they recalled from high school experiences. I was shocked. The kids said they'd never had a lab. At noon, I checked my email. A science department chair in Lincoln, Nebraska said, "You gotta help me." Help was the subject. They're saying that next year's budget will be $4.02 per student for the year for science supplies. Phys Ed gets $6. Career Ed had $8 per student. Science was $4.02. He said, "I can't find any data, but I need somebody to tell me what the average is or what I'm supposed to have." So we've got to get on board and help each other here. We have teachers that I think want to do labs. They don't have the opportunity. We have teachers that haven't a clue what to do with labs and how to do them. We finally get some teachers to do hands-on, but hands-on activities are recipe labs. There's no thought involved in it. You're looking for the right answer, and in fact, that's all you have to do is look at the bottom of the page and see if they've got the right answer and check it off. Then we're going to talk briefly about a structured inquiry and a guided inquiry and how those are steps that are crucial to both teachers and to your students' development. And then we'll get finally down here where we're going to have student-directed. And then finally, at the bottom of this list is actual student research. And I'm convinced that this is an evolution, a mental evolution, that has to happen for faculty, for students, and for teachers, pre-service teachers, because they really need to understand that this is not where it's at. But they've got to move, and they don't make giant leaps. You don't move from the top to the bottom. You've got to help people along that path. And so a group of my students actually designed this graphic, trying to explain, what's it look like? What are the steps? How can I determine where I am and where I need to go from here? So if you look along here, you end up having a complete list of procedures, protocol, and then that list that I gave above. And you can start to see that hands-on is really all about teacher. And when I worked in South America, I had to add two more columns to this. I literally did have lecture and demos, because there's just no way they were even on this chart. They weren't on this page. Structured, we finally let the students do some conclusions and analysis. And guided, now we actually would have the student involved in the procedures and deciding how they would pursue the question. You finally get over then to student directed, where the question itself is jointly developed. An interesting phenomena. And not until you really get over to student research do you really have where we're supposed to be going with a lot of our people. I really don't mind addressing any questions and thoughts as we go along in here. So if there's something really, that I goof up or that you have a question about, don't hesitate to ask and make a comment. I'm breaking protocols, aren't we? Teacher-centered, student-centered. Let's look at the next phenomena, maybe. Now, this is an example. Actually, the speakers prior to this have done a better job than I. This is a write-up that I have, and we've been requiring our teachers who are going to be science teachers at the secondary level to have a research experience now since 1984. The problem with that is that